From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now, a report out today from the World Health Organization on the origins of COVID-19 does not link the source to a live seafood and animal market in Wuhan, which was one of the early theories.
The report also calls the theory that a laboratory leak was responsible extremely unlikely. But the WHO does point to livestock farms in Southeast Asia as a possible origin. For more, let's bring in NPR's global health and development correspondent, Jason Beaubien. Jason, welcome.
Hi, Jane.
So besides the wildlife farm hypothesis, what else did we learn in the WHO's report today?
Well, we learned that getting a conclusive answer on where exactly this virus came from and how this whole pandemic started may never happen. And potential evidence that could have provided some of these answers at some of the wildlife farms and at the seafood and meat market in Wuhan, a lot of that was cleaned up and completely disappeared as Chinese authorities moved to sort of sanitize and deal with the early days of the pandemic. They basically looked at four different hypotheses. One is that the virus came from an intermediate host. It went from bats to some other animal and then into humans. Then they looked at another one where it went straight from bats into humans. And then they looked at frozen wild animal meat. And then the final one was looking at a laboratory leak. So they believe the most likely scenario is that it was in bats, went to some other animal that popped into humans. That's what they think is the most likely. And least likely, they're saying, is that it was leaked out of a lab.
Talk about the process of this, because I think that's really a question here. How did the WHO come to these conclusions?
There was a lot of discussion with China. China really pushed back against allowing this team to come in. There was a lot of resistance. But a lot of the way this worked was they said, we want this information. Their Chinese counterparts gathered it and then presented data to them.
Hmm. So the independent international scientists did not have access themselves. They were provided information by their Chinese counterparts who gathered the information and gave it to them.
Yes, for the most part, that is correct. And partly that's because they really only had 14 days on the ground to do this work. But yes, that definitely was this filter in between.
And what about this letter signed by over two dozen scientists, including at least one on the WHO committee, calling the study incomplete, that China essentially cherry-picked what the WHO researchers could see? Secretary of State Antony Blinken echoed those comments on CNN, and I'm just curious how confident the international community is in this report's findings.
The fact of the matter is they're dealing with China. They understand that Chinese authorities are notorious for being not open, oftentimes inside their own society, to providing information, and certainly not usually amenable to providing that to outsiders. There have been a lot of journalists who have been kicked out. Foreign journalists have been kicked out recently. The scientists that today were talking about this, they're saying that they believe that for the most part, Chinese authorities and the Chinese scientists there were helpful in trying to help them get to the bottom of this.
So back to this working theory now that has come out of this WHO report, that all of this started on a wildlife farm, farms that supplied vendors at that market in Wuhan. What happens at these farms and how could that have led to the emergence of COVID-19, Jason?
And just to be clear, they're not sure that it was the farms, but they believe that it was that type of scenario, which was most likely that you had wild animals, like there's a lot of bamboo rats, which are bred to, they're a delicacy in southern China. And there's a lot of congestion at these farms. And then you also have the humans that are there tending to them. So there's these opportunities both for spread of the virus within the animal population and the possibility for that to jump over to humans. So that's what the theory is. They believe it went from a bat to something else and then into humans. And they still haven't been able to nail down what that something else was. But they think that that is probably the type of place you would see it happen.
So just help us understand on a basic level why it's important for global health experts to pin down the actual source of the coronavirus, which sounds like we may never know.
The bottom line is the almost 3 million people who have died so far from this. And there's just the incredible impact that this has had to the entire world economy. Trying to make sure that this doesn't happen again is probably like the biggest question facing humanity right now. Because if we get through this one and then we have another one that hits in 5 years, we're really going to be in bad shape. If it is some problem with these wet markets, it's important to know so that we can try to prevent this in the future.
That is Jason Beaubien, NPR's global health and development correspondent, on a WHO report released today on the possible origins of the coronavirus pandemic. Jason, thank you so much.
No, it was my pleasure, Jane.
We're going to zoom in now on one community along the U.S.-Mexico border, because your perspective on the issue of immigration often depends on where you are. Texas is shouldering a surge of unaccompanied migrant children. Federal agents are allowing them in, but they've run out of beds in towns like McAllen. In Yuma, Arizona, Republican Mayor Douglas Nichols says his problem is different. He says federal agents have dropped off 1,700 migrants in his area since February, almost all of them trying to go to other places while their asylum cases are processed. But getting them the services they need has been a challenge. I recently spoke with Mayor Nichols and asked him who exactly is ending up in his community.
So they're primarily families, but there are single adults. They generally are from countries that don't have the ability to either repatriate right away, or they do have some sort of asylum or credible fear claim. Unaccompanied minors, while the numbers are up, those are not released into the community. Those are actually go through the HHS system.
And can you help me understand? My impression was that the Biden administration, for the most part, was sending migrants, even families, back over the border and not allowing them in the country. So how is it that they've come to be released in Yuma?
So what that has to do with, it depends on the country of origin. So if they are from Mexico, Title 42 is still enacted, and so they're able to return families or repatriate families and individuals immediately.
And Title 42 is the public health measure under the Trump administration, which basically says we're in a health emergency, nobody's coming in.
Title 42, I believe, is a permanent title. Just because we're in a pandemic, that's the reason that is enacted. As far as the other countries that are releasing, they're like, for example, Cuba, we don't have diplomatic relations with Cuba. So if Cubans are coming through, they need to be accommodated in the country or in the process somewhere until some determination can be made.
I see. So 1,700 migrants like this, have been dropped off in your city since February. Many of them quickly move on from the Yuma area to other places like shelters in Tucson, right?
That is correct. The problem is we do not have very many transportation opportunities out of Yuma unless you're buying an airline ticket. The Greyhound bus station here is not a station. It's actually a bench, and there's one bus a day that leaves Yuma. So with the reduced ability to get transportation out of the community, all we've done is created an extra step in the process for the migrants to get into Yuma, find a way out of Yuma, and then find a way onto their final destination, as opposed to working within the DHS system and releasing only in communities that have that robust transportation options and all the infrastructure that goes along with it.
Well, the city of Tucson might be an example of one of those places, and there's a shelter there I was visiting recently, speaking with Diego Javier Peña López. He's the program manager for Casa Alitas, and I asked him how he would describe the flow of migrants in Arizona. Here's what he said.
There's not very many people sitting out here and such, and even walking through the space. I'm not seeing that surge that we've all heard so much about. Currently, the numbers are not out of control wild. It's just where people are being released is a little unsettling at times.
So Diego there, agreeing with you that it doesn't seem wise to drop the migrants in places like Yuma. But what do you think about the other thing he's saying there, that at least in Arizona, he's not really seeing wild numbers, a huge surge?
For Yuma, we're a community of little over 200,000 people. And so if you have 1,700 people in a month, and if our nonprofit network ceases to be able to operate effectively, those are real numbers in our community. I think for a community like Yuma, this is an issue, and it's something that we need to be proactive. And if we just wait, it's like waiting for a hurricane to hit in order to prepare.
You've spoken with the Biden administration, I would presume. What did you hear from them? Have they been helpful?
So, yes, I did speak to the Biden administration. The result of that call was a trip to Yuma by FEMA and DHS medical officials to see firsthand the situation and talk to the community and to talk about funding and how the FEMA funding could support the nonprofit situation and setup that we've got going on. I'd say it's a good start. I think there's a long way to go.
Well, as you know, as someone who lives there, that this issue has become so politicized across the country over the last couple of months, as it often does. What is your message to people who don't live at the border that would help them understand what's actually happening there?
The best thing you could do is come visit. Nothing replaces putting eyes on exactly what's happening. But we need to look at the situation from an order of magnitude perspective. In 2019, we had 5,200 people come through our nonprofit network in 3 months. We're a month in, we're at 1,700. So we're starting to track roughly the same. That was all hands on deck to make sure that we had everything addressed and that the community could continue to operate as every community should be able to, and that the humanitarian needs for the people themselves of the migrants and of the community are taken care of.
Mayor Nichols, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you, guys.
Douglas Nichols is mayor of Yuma, Arizona.
The White House says that President Biden has no plans to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, a break with his predecessor who held 3 high-profile meetings with Kim. The North test-fired 2 short-range missiles earlier this month, the first ballistic missiles it has launched since Biden took office. Biden responded during his first press conference last week.
There will be responses if they choose to escalate. We will respond accordingly. But I'm also prepared for some form of diplomacy.
Gene Lee is the director of the Korea Center at the Wilson Center. Gene, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
What is your sense of what's going on right now? Is this Kim Jong-un testing a new administration in Washington?
Exactly. We're early in a new U.S. presidency, and what we're seeing is North Korea trying to feel out what their options are on strategy and trying to influence the policymaking in Washington, in Seoul, and in other capitals. And what we're seeing on the Washington side is the Biden administration saying, hey, there's a new sheriff in town. This is not going to be that era of summit diplomacy, that very theatrical summit diplomacy that President Trump carried out during his 4 years. It does kind of feel like we're heading toward back into this cycle of provocations and sanctions. We're not quite there yet, so this is the time to just make sure all of those steps are very carefully calculated.
So when President Biden says he is prepared for diplomacy with North Korea, what do you think he means? What does that diplomacy look like? You talk about a cycle of provocation and sanctions.
We have to remember that the Biden administration has not fully revealed what its North Korea policy will be. It's currently under review, and so they're tweaking some elements of it. But I think that that suggests that they are going to use sanctions as part of the diplomacy, and that the eventual goal is to get back to nuclear negotiations. This is something that the North Koreans are going to take note of. But what it does perhaps lead us to is that cycle of provocations, because both sides will be looking to increase their leverage. The North Koreans are going to be thinking, well, when we get to that negotiating table, we want to have more in our arsenal. And the Americans may be thinking, well, we've got to have something that we can negotiate with. And often that is sanctions.
And so what is the North's nuclear strength right now? And what do we know about Kim's nuclear weapons and his ability to use them?
I think it's really important to recognize that North Korea's arsenal is far stronger in 2021 than it was in 2017. So this is going to be a very different game than it was when President Trump first took office 4 years ago. Now, it may seem like North Korea has been quiet for the last couple of years, but they have been continuing to test ballistic missiles. They've tested more than 30 missiles even after the diplomacy and the bromance between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. And every test, even if it's not a major one that captures the headlines, goes toward improving some aspect of their technology. And that means the stakes are higher on both sides. And so this is going to be a very, very tricky negotiation when we get to that table.
So the last 4 years actually strengthened Kim's arsenal. You say they're stronger now from a nuclear perspective in 2021 than they were in 2017.
That's an important thing to remember, because I think that we tend to assume that North Korea was somewhat quiet, but that was President Trump also turning a blind eye to the missile launches. And that's something that the Biden administration is seeking to signal, is that every time you test a ballistic missile, it is a violation of UN Security Council resolutions, and we are going to take a stand and we're going to respond.
So the North clearly poses a threat to South Korea and Japan. Do those countries have any leverage at this point over Kim?
The leverage that these countries have, and this is what we'll see Washington do, is try to get South Korea and Japan on board as part of a regional strategy with the United States. And I think we'll start to see some of that happen. We've got the national security advisors of both Japan and South Korea going to Washington this week to meet with the national security advisor in Washington, and to try to work together on a strategy that's cohesive and that is united, so that North Korea can't divide and conquer and drive a wedge between these allies.
So talk about that regional strategy, Jean. What about China's influence in all this with Kim Jong-un and North Korea?
Absolutely. I think as we see Japan, South Korea, and the United States work on a strategy together, if we're not seeing progress on U.S.-North Korean relations, we may see North Korea trying to get China on board and get support from China. I think we'll probably start to see some more trade between China and North Korea. We may even see North Korea send a delegation to the Beijing Olympics, which is coming up next year, and for China to step in and try to play that role as a country that can take the lead on diplomacy when it comes to North Korea. That will have to be part of the larger strategy the Biden administration is trying to roll out or carry out in the region, is to get China on board to a certain degree when it comes to North Korea.
Jean Lee is director of the Center for Korean History and Public Policy at the Wilson Center. Jean, thank you very much for your perspective and for speaking with us.
Thanks. It was great to join you today.
A federal order protecting renters from eviction was set to expire tomorrow, but now the CDC has extended those protections for 3 more months through the end of June. Still, thousands of people have already been evicted, either before the CDC order went into effect or because landlords used loopholes to get around it. That's left a lot of people struggling to find a place to live during the pandemic, and PR's Chris Arnold has one man's story in this piece that originally aired on Morning Edition.
Getting evicted can hurt you in a bunch of different ways. And you don't have to tell that to 57-year-old Gregory Curry in Dothan, Alabama.
I'll be honest with you. I was petrified by this situation, what I've had to go through over this last year.
Curry fell behind on rent after the furniture store where he was a salesman shut down due to COVID. His landlord filed an eviction case against him back over the summer. Curry had nowhere to go, but there was no federal eviction moratorium in place at the time, and the judge ordered him to leave.
They told me I had to be out. Now, mind you, I had 5 rooms of furniture because I had an upstairs, downstairs duplex.
Curry says he'd never been evicted before, and he really didn't know what to do next. He got a storage unit, and he had a friend with a truck come help him the day that he had to leave. But while they moved a load of stuff to storage, he says the landlord quickly changed the locks and just tossed the rest of his things outside.
They had come in there and threw them out on the road. I was devastated, and the neighbors were literally coming by and taking my things.
Curry's landlord, a company called D-Ream Properties, did not respond to NPR's request for an interview. Court records show that the landlord added legal fees for the eviction and other charges on top of what he owed in rent. And when the furniture store reopened and Curry started working again...
I'm at work. In comes the sheriff. And he says, are you Gregory Curry? And I said, yeah, I am. And he looks at me and he said, well, I got a letter for you. And it was a garnishment.
That's a wage garnishment. In other words, Curry says his landlord started seizing 25% of his wages. And now with an eviction on his record, he ran into a cold, hard truth of getting evicted. When you look for a new place to live, many landlords check the court records, or at least ask if you've ever been evicted. And if they're looking at two people, one with an eviction and the other not, for many, that makes the decision pretty easy. So for more than 7 months now, Curry hasn't had a home. That's even though he's had a job. He stayed at long-term stay hotels when he's had enough money to do that.
I literally had to sleep in my car simply because of the fact that, you know, what I'm paying here at these extended stay hotels is actually more than what I was paying for rent and utilities. So when you've maxed out all your, you know, what couple of credit cards you have, and then you can't even borrow money, you know, because everything is just falling apart all at the same time. I mean, the emotional toll has been more than the actual financial toll.
Meanwhile, Curry's been driving 30 miles every other day to make sure his mom's okay at a nursing home. And he's still just kind of mystified by everything that's happened. If there's a safety net, Curry seems to have fallen through it.
This is outrageous that this is going on in the United States of America.
Rochelle Gretchen is a legal aid attorney in Alabama, where Gregory Curry lives. She says she's seen a lot of people in his situation during the pandemic and before. You get evicted and nobody will rent you another place.
It's tough. And even if we have clients where we can get the eviction dismissed or they come to some sort of a settlement agreement, the court records will show that an eviction was filed. So it shows up when future landlords are looking.
One bill in Congress introduced this month in the House would stop credit bureaus from putting evictions during the pandemic on people's credit reports. Gretchen says, too, when you're stuck unable to find another home, evictions can send people into a downward spiral.
A lot of times it snowballs. You know, you might have trouble with making your car payment if you're having to make a weekly motel fee that's more, you know, more than your rent. And then you might have trouble keeping your car. If you end up losing your car, your job's at risk.
Gregory Curry feels lucky that he hasn't lost his car and that he hasn't gotten COVID, even though evictions can raise the risk of that. And in just the past few days, his luck has changed in other ways, too. After more than 7 months, a family member has helped him find a landlord who will finally rent him a place. And a homeless assistance group is giving him first and last month's rent so he can move in.
I'm very relieved right now because this has been quite a road.
We reached him on his cell phone as he was just starting to move stuff into his new place.
I'm just grateful to be able to have recovered from this, you know. I'm a pretty strong guy, but this was a really rough situation.
Curry was hesitant about sharing his story, but decided that he wanted to because he doesn't think that this should be happening to people in a pandemic. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
How is COVID changing the college experience? What's driving the increase in crossings at the border? Why did Colorado's gun laws fail to prevent a mass shooting there? Listen for answers, backstory, and analysis beyond the day's headlines on Consider This from NPR.
The Suez Canal is clear, and ships are slowly moving through that vital waterway that connects the Red Sea to the Mediterranean through Egypt. Engineers yesterday dislodged a 1,300-foot container ship called the Ever Given that blocked the canal for almost a week. Now hundreds of vessels are still waiting to get through, raising concerns about further disruptions to the global supply chain. Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
How are you?
Well, I'm well, thank you. The Ever Given has now been moved to a place called Great Bitter Lake, which I guess is the widest part of the Suez Canal. How did engineers finally dislodge it?
My rabbi, for his part, is calling it a Passover miracle. But if you step back from it, it's a true combination of man hours, machines, and Mother Nature, Jane. So much sand and sediment was dug out, dredgers and pumping left and right, while tugboats, I think more than a dozen, pushed and pulled on ends of this skyscraper-sized tanker just as the full moon spring high tides added precious water to the canal's height, making removal easier.
Mm. Well, and authorities say 437 ships in total were stalled by the Ever Given. More than 100 of those have made it through the canal since the container ship was freed. But this can take a long time. I mean, more than 10 hours for a ship to cross that 120-mile canal. Talk about the backlog here. How long might this take to fix it?
The backlog will clear while Egypt's proud ruler said it's going to take 3 days to clear. Other analysts are eyeing more than a week. Perhaps I saw some Wall Street reports into 2 weeks, but that's still preferable to the Cape of Good Hope detour at the bottom tip of Africa. That would have been a 3,000-mile reroute that could have eaten up weeks.
Yeah. So 13% of global sea trade goes through the Suez Canal. What kind of products are sitting on those ships waiting to get through?
Gosh, you name it. Cattle, other agricultural goods, oil, natural gas, toys. Last year, approximately 19,000 vessels took their wares between the Mediterranean and the Red Sea. Mm.
Well, and there's a huge ripple effect here, right? Because once all those ships get through the canal, there will be congestion at ports around the world, I suspect. Help us understand what this means for the global supply chain.
The ripples are going to be felt for a while. After all, hundreds of ships destined for ports were seriously delayed. How long is it going to take for them to have to idle at bay awaiting new slots and labor and machinery? What about the trucks and trains that were scheduled to move what was in those containers? How much perishable or agricultural cargo was lost to spoilage? Still, it's lucky on balance that this didn't happen during the Christmas shopping season and that global supply chains, which have already been taxed during the pandemic, they've largely absorbed the shock.
Mm. Well, and an investigation is underway now into what caused the blockage of the Suez Canal. Do they know? Do they have any ideas?
Well, I mean, you had an enormous vessel with an enormous boot and various things in nature that happened that got it to beach. And so people are going to be questioning, is the Suez sufficiently dredged? I saw a stat already that cost of renting certain cargoes for Asia-Middle East trade had soared to $2.2 million. It's suddenly a lot riskier. The Russians are trying to hype their northern sea route. So this is going to cause a wake-up call to global trade, which is a multi-trillion dollar world. You're going to be rethinking the size of shipping containers, routes. It was certainly a clarion call.
Indeed it was. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Robin, thank you.
Thank you.
Could you imagine a world without email? Our next guest can. Computer science professor Cal Newport has written a book about how email not only destroys our productivity at work, but also makes us miserable. Cal, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And the book is called A World Without Email. So make your case. Why would that be a better world to live in and to work in?
I don't actually mean that email as a tool should go away. I don't want to go back to using fax machines again or voicemail. But the thing that I do think we need to get past is the style of work that was enabled once email arrived. It's a style of work I call the hyperactive hive mind. And it's when we do most of our collaboration with back and forth unscheduled ad hoc digital messaging. It's that style of work that email made possible. That's the problem. That's what we need to do away with.
Let's talk more about that phrase that you use throughout the book, the hyperactive hive mind. That does not sound good. What does it mean to you?
It's where we basically say we're all connected with these digital channels. It could be Slack. It could be Microsoft Teams. It could be email. And it says the way we work things out, the way we coordinate or collaborate is just ad hoc unscheduled messages. I just grab you over email. You reply right away. Everyone is connected like we're one big hive mind, and task and question information is freely bouncing around between all of these different nodes.
What's the problem with working that way?
Well, it's a good question because there are some obvious advantages, which we should acknowledge. It's easy. It's flexible. The issue is, however, it doesn't scale. So once you have many people that you're trying to collaborate with on many different initiatives, the number of messages you now have to keep up with means that you have to constantly check inboxes or constantly check chat channels. And it's these constant checks that's killing us right now. Our mind cannot do these rapid context shifts from one thing to an inbox, back to the one thing, back to an inbox. These constant context shifts are really reducing our ability to think clearly. They are giving us mental fatigue, and it's making us unhappy.
Well, now, wait a minute. A lot of people would raise their hand and say, not me. Like, I'm really good at multitasking. I can handle this.
Well, I would check to make sure they were not a cyborg first. And if they're not a cyborg, if there's not a computer chip in their head, they aren't good at it. And I spent a lot of time with this book with both psychologists and neuroscientists who both study this phenomenon of network switching. Humans can't network switch quickly. It takes time for us to take this wetware and move it from one point of focus to another. It's a whole biochemical cascade that involves networks being amplified and networks being inhibited. It can take 5, 10, 15 minutes. we can't check an inbox once every 6 minutes, like I found in one study I reported on, and expect to still be able to think clearly.
Really? That's how often some people are checking their emails? I guess that may be how often I check my emails. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a shocking number. This is actually was a data set that came from a software company called Rescue Time, and it's based off of tens of thousands of different clients of theirs. And it was once every 6 minutes, unless your organization uses Slack, and then it's even quicker.
Wow. So that just destroys productivity, you're saying, right?
Yeah, we can't think clearly. It also exhausts us. It's why by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we just give up on work and just fall back into our inbox in a sort of a stupor. It's because it exhausts our brain, all the switching, and it makes us anxious. So it's like a double whammy of terribleness.
Okay, let's talk about why all those messages piling up in our inbox makes us anxious. Is there science behind that?
One of my arguments in the book, and there's some data to back this up, is that when we have an inbox that we know is filling with messages from people we know, and we're not answering them in the moment, that sets off alarm bells in our brain. Our brain thinks, look, there's tribe members who need me and I'm ignoring them. That is not a good thing to do. So our Paleolithic social brains don't do well with these digital modern ways of communicating.
Cal, do you remember in the 1990s when we loved email? It was like the most exciting thing ever happened. We just loved it. How did it go from an innovation to something that we dread, but that we can't move away from?
It was an interesting history to unearth. I mean, so we basically get from about 1990 to 1995, the rapid spread of email. In 1998, we get the Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan movie, You Got Mail, where people are excited and high-fiving because an email arrived in their email box. By the time we get to 2004, you can begin to find productivity authors talking about email overload as if, of course, everyone knows what this is. So basically, it spread in 5 years. We had 5 good years, and then overload became an issue.
Well, and now it's way beyond email. And you've mentioned this a little bit. Some offices, my own included, are moving into platforms like Slack that require an even faster response time than email. What do you think about something like Slack? Is it the kind of technology that's actually making this whole problem even worse?
Yeah, Slack is interesting. So earlier this fall, when Salesforce announced they were going to acquire Slack for a very large amount of money, I wrote an article for The New Yorker. They asked me to write about what are my thoughts on Slack. And what I titled that article was Slack built the right tool for the wrong way to work. Basically, Slack said, oh, if the hyperactive hive mind is how we're collaborating, we'll build a better tool for the hyperactive hive mind. It'll be an easier way to do this ongoing ad hoc back and forth communication. We'll get rid of some of the rough edges of email. So we both love and hate Slack. We love it because if we're using the hive mind, it's a slicker tool, but we also hate the hive mind.
So for better or worse, this is just the way things are for many of us when we go to work. And arguably, it's going to take some other form of revolutionary technology to get us off this dependency on email, right? So how do you suggest we try to leave this hive mind behind?
Right. Well, I don't think we need revolutionary technology. We need revolutionary thinking about how we organize knowledge work. What if, for example, we look to software development, where they don't use the hyperactive hive mind? They use agile methodologies where all of the tasks are up on a shared transparent task boards, and they have highly structured daily status meetings to see who's working on what. They carefully titrate how much work any one person is doing at the same time. We've seen this type of innovative thinking in very narrow examples. We need to spread that to many more sectors.
Okay, the problem is what you just said and described, I don't understand. And so I wonder what the challenges would be to changing the way we work and what kind of pushback you might get from workers or managers or people who run these companies.
Well, the interesting thing about this particular issue, which makes it different than other types of problems we've had in the world of work before, is that actually management and employees are on the same page here, that we need to do something better. So what's really holding us back? We have an ethic of autonomy in knowledge work. We have to pull back this autonomy trap and said, actually, wait. This is not all just up to the individuals to figure out. Let's think what's best for our company or our team or our organization. And once we start thinking that way, there's a lot of innovation that will follow. That's going to make everybody happy.
Okay, so your book has some case studies that highlight what some CEOs or companies are doing to make a better choice for them. Tell me about one of those.
Well, for example, I talk about a marketing firm, a small marketing firm, and they got completely burnt out on the hive mind. And they switched all of their client information from emails to Trello boards. Every client had its own Trello board. All of the information related to that client was on the board. everything that needed to be done for that client was on the board in a column that said what its status is. You could see who was working on it, all the files, the transcripts from calls, research, all of it was in one place, not in an inbox spread among emails. And then they updated these boards almost like software developers with these structured status meetings. Okay, everyone get together real quick. What's going on with this client? Who's working on what? What do you need to get that thing done? We're all on the same page. Great. We'll talk in 2 days.
I just opened up my inbox for work. Venture a guess how many unread messages I have?
I don't know if I want to. They'll say my neighbor sent me a picture yesterday. He had 666 unread messages. And he said, I think the universe is trying to tell me something about email here.
Oh, well, I've got that beat. 36,712 unread emails. I can't even imagine what I've missed in that pile. But I think I hear your point. Something is wrong. Something is broken. And a lot of people went through a lot of time to send those 36,000 emails that never crossed my eyes. Cal, the pandemic has changed the way that we work. It's true. And in some cases, people are going to continue working remotely even after this crisis is over. What about that? Does that make your vision for a world without email even tougher to pull off?
I think it makes it more urgent. I think what we experienced during this period of forced remote work is that the hyperactive hive mind became more hyperactive, more emails, more impromptu Zoom, more Slack messages, much less time to actually work. I hear from a lot of people right now who say, you know what? I now do zero work during my workday. Every minute is Zoom or email. This is an absurd state of affairs. I can't believe that we're willing to say, I guess that's just the best way to work. So I think the pandemic has really emphasized our need for something much more structured than the hive mind. We need a much more structured way to work, because when you're just completely ad hoc and informal, complete remote work does not work well at all.
Hmm. Cal Newport, the new book is called A World Without Email, Reimagining Work in an Age of Communication Overload. Amen to that. Cal, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
And am I the only one out there with 36,000 unread emails? I bet some of you have actually got me beat. Let us know how buried you are by technology. We're at letters@hereandnow.org.
We've heard about how challenging teaching school during the pandemic has been, but teaching theater, when most of the kids are learning remotely, has been particularly difficult. We have a story now about how two high schools have responded to the obstacles they face. It begins and ends with productions of the musical A Chorus Line. Jeff London reports.
A year ago, Jadalyn Pledger was ecstatic. A student at the Akron School for the Arts in Ohio, she was cast in their Big Spring musical.
I was Judy Turner. She was my first sort of supporting role, I guess. It was my sophomore year, so I was like, oh yeah, like I'm with the big dogs, you know? I get to be in the line. And then March 13th, Friday the 13th, is when we got the news the school was closing.
A Chorus Line, a show about dancers at a Broadway audition, was just a few weeks from its first performance. But teacher Mark Zimmerman decided to gather the cast on stage that day to make a video of the show's big ballad, What I Did for Love, just in case they didn't return.
Kiss today goodbye. And pointing toward tomorrow.
The cue for the song is, you know, what would you do if you had to stop dancing? And the answer is, I regret nothing. Because I did it for the love of the dance, and that's all I need. And I'm getting a lot emotional now.
Jadalyn Pledger says in the weeks after school closed, she and her castmates kept rehearsing over FaceTime to stay sharp. They still expected the show to go on.
Then we figured out that school was not opening for the rest of the year. And that was when the shock came. Because when you work towards something that's so pivotal and so formative, I just still feel that heaviness on my heart from that experience.
A Chorus Line was canceled, and Pledger herself came down with COVID. Since then, she and her classmates have been learning remotely. Drama teacher Mark Zimmerman says when he works in the classroom,
you kind of control the ebb and flow of learning and instruction, and Online, you don't have any control over any of that because you have no idea what the environment is that the kids are in. They, for the most part, do not turn on their cameras. They, for the most part, will not turn on their microphones unless they have something to say.
And Jadalyn Pledger says she's feeling a loss, not just of performing live, but of the community that comes with it.
So I struggled with the passion that I had for it fizzing out, and I can say confidently that a lot of my classmates did as well.
Since then, the Akron School for the Arts has managed to put some shows online. Still, it isn't the same, says senior Peter Coolidge.
Just from like an acting standpoint, it's hard to make an emotional connection with someone else's character when they're just like a little box and not a person in front of you.
Theater kids all over the country are facing these challenges, like the students at Great Neck South High School in Long Island, which has been operating on a hybrid model with some students in the classroom, but most learning remotely.
Up the steep and very narrow stairway to the voice like a metronome.
Despite all the obstacles, they've been working on a chorus line this year. Drama teacher Tommy Marr conceived it as an online production because he thought it could translate.
It's a lot of talking directly to the audience, and I thought that that would work well on a Zoom platform. I liked the idea that all of these characters wanted to do was perform, but there are all these barriers in the way of doing what it is that they want to do. In this case, making it through the audition. In our case, COVID.
Junior Rosanna Gao says it's been challenging to rehearse music and dance routines over Zoom, not to mention making videos at home.
Doing lighting, camera work, making sure that your costume is good, your makeup is good, and where you're standing is good as well. So it's like a whole process. But I think I definitely learned a lot, but it was very difficult.
Yes, everything was beautiful at the ballet.
Her castmate, Ellie Weitzman, agrees.
This isn't what I wanted my senior year to look like. But I feel a great deal of pride in the fact that I was able to extract even something from this process.
Drama teacher Tommy Marr says despite all the changes the pandemic has brought to his students, he's proud of how they've adapted.
My line is always that you never should underestimate the resilience of teenagers.
Once everything's edited, Great Neck South's production of A Chorus Line will be available online sometime this spring. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.